Hello, I'm Erica Kitzman. Thank you for tuning in to Stay. Stay was inspired by the need to find a way to discuss the hard topic of suicide while learning how to build resiliency in ourselves and in our community. Staying alive is the obvious cure for suicide, and together with our community members, we can learn and teach the skills that we need to stay alive in times of stress or crisis. Each week, we will listen as community members discuss ways to build resilience in ourselves and in our community. Stay is an educational public service show and is not meant to replace clinical or medical care. If at any time during this show you feel the need to talk to somebody, please text TALK to 38255 in Colorado or HOME to 741741 anywhere else in the United States. Please stay tuned and listen in. Today we have Juliet Carr, founder of Attempted Suicide Help and author of the book by the same name. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to see you.
Thanks. My first question for you is, how did you become interested in helping families and friends of suicide attempt survivors?
Well, about 12 years ago, I had a family member who had attempted suicide twice and lived through both attempts. And through that time, we kind of came together as a family and were looking for resources and information and tools, anything that would kind of make us help feel validated, feel like what we were doing was either right or wrong, because sometimes knowing that you're wrong is really powerful as well, and wanted to know how to keep him alive and what to say and what not to say and all of those things. I wanted to know what to tell my children. And there weren't really any resources. And the information that I did find was very shaming and really awful. And at the time I thought, someone has to do something and it's not going to be me because this is not what I want my life to be about. And so for about 2 years, I kept kind of coming into that same wall every time I'd reach out and ask for help or ask for resources and continually got really awful things thrown back at me. And then I went to the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Colorado Board of Directors and asked them if there were resources out there that we just couldn't find because we weren't thinking straight. And at the time, I think all 20 of them just sat with their mouths open looking at me. And the answer was a resounding no, there aren't any resources. So I went back home and I took a little bit of time and tried to figure out if this was something that was going to fit into my life and if it was that important. And I would walk away and it would come back and I would walk away and it would come back. And so I feel like it's really my purpose. One of my purposes in life was to bring these resources forward.
What specific resources have you found that are lacking and how have you gone about changing that?
So the first resource that we really felt like would have been useful was a website, because immediately when something like this happens, and it doesn't matter what diagnosis or accident happens, you know, if you hurt your knee, you usually Google torn ACL, or if you get a diagnosis, you Google it and you try and find as many resources and as much good information as possible. When I started a nonprofit and wanted to raise money so that I could publish attemptedsuicidehelp.com so that that website was available so people could access it in the privacy of their own home 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's the first thing.
The website's live. I found it a few years ago. It didn't exactly suit my needs, but I was blown away that it existed. What resources are on your site that are different from other sites?
So some of the resources that are available, I have a checklist for families to take to a mental health provider. I have resources for everyone that's been affected by an attempted suicide, whether it's the person who attempted suicide, whether it's their family members, whether it's first responders. There wasn't anyone that I wanted left out of the information that was provided.
AFSP, which is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and SAMHSA both publish how-to guides for caring for a loved one after a suicide attempt. Would you advocate for a how-to guide for caregivers as well?
I would say absolutely. I believe, so after I published the website, I kept getting tugged at my heartstrings and wanted to use the information and the research that I'd done to help. And the second thing that myself and my family members felt like was very important when we went through this was a book. something that was substantial that you could hold, that you could dog ear, that you could highlight, that you could underline, that you could scribble notes in the margins, something that would fit in a purse or a briefcase. And again, something that felt pretty, that wasn't glaringly like, hey, my family member attempted suicide, look at me. So the second thing that I did was publish a book, Attempted Suicide, The Essential Guidebook for Loved Ones. And so I believe that that's what I've created, is that how-to guide of how to care for yourself, what things that you go through, what are common experiences, and maybe things that aren't so common. Just because I found commonalities in the people I researched doesn't mean that the things that weren't common aren't more common now or less common. So I included everything.
After referring people for years to your website, when your book was published last year, I read it. And even after being very familiar with your context and your content, with the book, I found myself being acknowledged for how I felt as a child when my family members attempted. Can you speak to that?
I think the website was created to support everyone, and it didn't go as in-depth. I think that's the point in a book, and I think that that's the power of books or paper goods, is that when you hold something, it's real. It's not just on a screen. It's something that you have. The information that I included in the book was very specific to family members as well, because that's what it was written for, was it was a guidebook for loved ones. So I interviewed people who had had a loved one attempt suicide and not complete, and just tried to find their commonalities and what they had experienced and what they needed and how I could best go about creating that.
I have to say that while I was reading the book, I wondered if attempt survivors' families were brought in both as caregivers and needing care themselves, if this would increase the likelihood of people staying alive more so than what's currently being done.
With the people that I interviewed, all felt like they weren't equipped to keep someone alive after a suicide attempt. So they will pick them up from the hospital or pick them up from the mental health institution when their loved one is released and bring them home. And when I wrote this book, most of them did not have a follow-up appointment with any mental health professional, any mental health provider, any other just general practitioner. And most people were left shamed when the attempt happened. Like, why didn't you stop it? What did you do? What were the incidents leading up to that? Why didn't you call for help? And then 3 days later, the majority of the time, these people are released to their family members who were blamed for the attempt. And then they have to try and keep, like, pick all the pieces up, keep the children fed, go to their job, pay their bills, and try and keep this person alive, who at the time probably still doesn't want to live. To be realistic, that doesn't go away in 3 days. So I think that having those tools for caregivers is incredibly important. I think it increases resiliency. I think it increases compassion. I think it increases the fact that people don't feel isolated or alone. When you have tools for someone, they automatically feel like they have a community or a tribe or a home. When you don't, and we're talking about millions of people annually in the United States, they are left feeling isolated, scared, hopeless, helpless, which is all the signs of depression, which also lead up to suicide attempts and completions.
So you're saying that families and loved ones of people who attempt need aftercare as well?
Absolutely, 100%. I advocate for that so strongly in getting an appointment with a mental health therapist as soon as possible after an attempt for everyone that's been affected. Children, most importantly. I think sometimes as adults, we think we're going to be fine and we can power through it and we have support or we just don't care or whatever the case may be. But I think children are incredibly impacted by the things that they overhear or that they see that we either try to hide or talk around or over or about. One of the people that I interviewed was incredibly angry about his brother who had attempted a couple of different times in a short period of time. And he just really couldn't rationalize why his brother would have attempted. He was so angry. He just thought, there's no way that I would ever do this to my own wife, my own children. He was just pissed. And then one day he was driving home and the thought of a suicide attempt came in his mind. And it was it was like a rational tool in his toolbox at that point. It was like something that had been automatically put there without your acceptance. You've been mad about it, but all of a sudden it becomes a useful tool that you think might work for you, even when you know it won't, even when you've been angry at other people. And so being able to work through that, especially when you've already been angry at someone for attempting suicide and then thinking that that's a rational solution for your own problems, is nearly crazy making in and of itself. It makes you really second guess your own sanity and your own ability to make good decisions.
How do you think that we as a society can prevent suicidality?
I think one of the most important things that I've heard when interviewing loved ones and people who've attempted is to decriminalize and destigmatize a suicide attempt. I think that the Baker's Act was a really important tool at the time. I think it was something that as a society, we felt like would be a really good idea. Like, let's keep these people safe while there's a crisis, and then we can send them home. The tools to back that up haven't been implemented. And so instead, what it's created is a society who's afraid to ask for help when we need it, because we're afraid of being locked up and treated like criminals for 3 days, and then you're left to go home with no further resources, no further tools, no further skills to handle whatever crisis you're having in your life. And what that creates is people that say, I'm never asking for help again. I would sooner die than be locked up again. And that is not a useful solution for humanity at all.
Are there particular trainings that you would recommend for parents and children, anybody really?
I believe through following your work that mental health first aid is a really great tool. I have not personally taken that one. I've taken a step back from my advocacy work locally for quite a few years to finish up my first book and then to nearly complete my second one. I think that mental health first aid is important.
The things that I've found useful with mental health first aid are just really little small things that have stuck with me. For instance, commenting on somebody's body size is a heads up that a person has an eating disorder. Who knew? I didn't know that. And I grew up with that.
Right.
So there are a lot of tiny little tools that I got that have really helped my life. And my husband took mental health first aid for youth. He's a teacher, and he has found it enormously successful. And that's why I'm such a big fan now. What would you change about the treatment of humans with mental illness?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I think compassion is important. I think I've had other family members that have been diagnosed incorrectly, medicated incorrectly, been in the middle of a psychosis after they've tried to advocate for themselves and said, this medicine isn't working. I'm having suicidal and homicidal thoughts and actions. I need it changed. And the advice was, keep taking your medication, your appointment's in 2.5 weeks. And so then that person was hauled off in handcuffs. That is not a useful solution. I don't think that's compassionate. I think that we need to change the way that the whole mental health system works. If you have a broken arm, you go to the doctor and you get an x-ray and they set it, or they give you pain medicine and then they set it, or they do surgery, but you have a set of expectations of how long it's going to take to heal. And the mental health industry is the only industry that I can think of that will allow someone in crisis to call and they will say, hey, I think you're going to be okay. My next appointment's in 11 weeks. Hang in there. What in the world? No one else would make someone with cancer wait 11 weeks for a treatment or a broken leg. Why has it been acceptable? And I really think that the mental health industry increases the stigma because of that. They're feeding into it by making it so that access to care that is compassionate and timely is not, at least, like, not attainable for most of the humans in the United States. Access to timely, really compassionate care is important, and timely is important within 24 hours. If someone finally has the courage to pick up the stinking phone and they are at that wit's end in this stigma-driven society to ask for help, it is completely unacceptable to say no.
So I'm guessing on the Western Slope that you would advocate for more beds We have 32 currently for all of the mental health emergencies from Steamboat Springs down to Durango and West.
More so even than beds. But even more so than that, a lot of people, myself included, when they were in crisis, I felt suicidal. I felt like I didn't have the tools or the resources that I needed. I don't know that I needed to be Baker acted or locked up or have a bed, but I definitely needed someone to sit down with me and say, here's a few resources that you can have for the next 24, 48, 62, 72, 84 hours till next week when I can see you. And then here's what you're going to expect. If someone needs to be medicated, here's the side effects that you might experience, and call in their spouse or their parent or their friend who lives with them and say, here's what you need to look out for. I think one of the things that we need to be really mindful of as a society that would reduce suicide in a moment is to restrict access to means. I'm still so heartbroken every time we lose a life when family members or friends can say, I knew this person was struggling and I left them at home. First of all, they were left alone. And second of all, they were left with all the means that are in most houses in Western Colorado. There's a lot. I mean, even to taking away someone's keys, it's acceptable to do that when someone's drinking. And it needs to be acceptable to do when someone's in a mental health crisis. It needs to be acceptable to say, hey, I care about you and I want you to live through this. And I'm scared out of my mind. I'm afraid you're going to be angry with me. I'm afraid that our friendship might not make it through this, but I'm unwilling to let you die. Because of that, I am taking away all of these means to access to die, and I'll return them to you. I don't know that I would advocate for a law with that right now. I ride the fence on both of that, but I think as friends and family members and loved ones, you have to restrict means.
You're listening to Stay, a program about suicide prevention and postvention and our community resilience response. We're here with Juliette Carr from Attempted Suicide Help, which is a foundation and also the title of a book that she wrote and published. So mental health in general has a stigma, often making people feel shame about getting help. How does the work you've done fight against that stigma and also help those who may be suffering in silence?
Specifically, that work helps people who are suffering in silence because they do have access to the website and the privacy of their own home. I have also worked to do a Twitter feed and a Facebook page. And one of the things that I created was an ASH mantra, which Attempted Suicide Help also stands for acceptance, strength, and healing. And so I did a mantra a day for a year, just really wanting to leave something else out there. There can't just be one tool. There's not one solution for everyone. So that was just one more tool for people if they're feeling afraid or alone and they don't want to pick up a phone and they don't want to try and make an appointment, or they've been told no too many times, that they can go to that newsfeed. And if you type in the hashtag ASH mantra, there's at least 365 mantras that you can use in the privacy of your own home to try and find peace and comfort and calm and make yourself really more healthy.
It's sort of a how-to to get yourself out of a crisis.
Absolutely.
Or to help yourself. If I'm a person who's never been affected by attempted suicide or suicide, but still want to help with awareness, what would you suggest?
I think the first thing I would suggest is taking the Mental Health America or first aid class, like you talked about. And I really considered this question. I think the second thing that I would encourage people to do, because I talk to so many people who are like, well, I've never been depressed and I've never experienced that in my family and I wouldn't even know where to start. It's so foreign to me. Pretend like someone you love dearly, whether it's your child, your spouse, your best friend, your parent, is in crisis and suicidal. Pick up the phone. Put yourself in those shoes. What number do you call? When you call that number, who answers? What resources or none do they give you? How long are they going to make you wait for help? And then realize that you're not in crisis. You're healthy. Your loved ones are healthy. And you can probably advocate for those of us who aren't better than anyone, because you might be a little bit more eloquent. You might have your head on a little bit more straight that day. But I strongly recommend that people do that because they don't understand. They think, well, there's a center for mental health down the street and there is the emergency room at the hospital and there's 14 counselors in our community and there's counselors at the school. So that's enough. And what they don't realize is that when they're in crisis, it's not enough. It's not enough in our area. It's not enough in our nation. It hasn't been addressed enough. It hasn't been funded enough. It hasn't been talked about enough. And I think that that's one of the other things that my advocacy work does is when people, I just had a very dear friend whose boyfriend watched the YouTube video that I was in and he said, "Holy crap. What in the world? She has 3 kids and she's been through all of this and she's still advocating to help and writing books and, you know, doing blog posts to help other people." And it was so empowering for me to say, proof that mental health doesn't have to define you. Because yeah, it probably looks like that's really great and it's really amazing. But when you're in the middle of it and you're just doing the next action or writing the next sentence or doing the next Facebook post, it's not that big of a deal. Everybody does that every day. It might be negative. It might be folly and just that you went down and got a coffee, but you're doing that every day already.
Have you been shamed for feeling grief?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Publicly, privately, on the phone, when I reached out to suicide prevention organizations, what I was told by local and national organizations was things like, "You should be ashamed of doing this work. You don't know anything about suicide. You should be doing everything you can to keep your family member alive because that's what's important. You have no right to be doing this. You don't know what I would give to have my sister or my brother or my dad back for one day. And what you're doing is folly." Here's my least favorite one. When your family member does die by suicide, you can join our group and we have resources for you. But until then, we don't have anything.
It breaks my heart to hear that. And I will tell you why, because I am a family member of multiple attempt survivors. And I'm also a loss survivor. But I really feel like you have hit upon an area of postvention that's similar to caregiver support for hospice patients. When I was a kid, nobody knew that cancer caregivers sometimes died before the patient. Same thing with AIDS. We didn't know that caregivers died sometimes before the patient because it was so heartbreaking and stressful. So I see what you're doing as life-affirming. I see you as a progressive in the postvention field.
I feel like a progressive. I didn't at the time. I felt very scared. I really wanted validation. I wanted people to sit on my board of directors that were doctors because I felt like I'm just a mom. And the ironic thing about that is when I've interviewed people and I've been able to help people locally and connect them to resources behind closed doors, via text, or under the rug, because we have great providers here as well, that's the tool. That's the ticket. I'm just a mom. People can say, "Who do you report to?" "Oh, because I'm on probation and I'm not supposed to be drinking." "But I am." Well, of course you are. You don't have access to the medication that you've been prescribed. You don't have the money to get it. You don't have the support to get to your therapist. Yes, you're self-medicating. That's what we do as human beings. We want to feel steady, stable, normal, quote unquote, healthy. And if that's what your healthy is, if that's what your normal is, that's when you're not feeling completely manic or really, really depressed, that's what you're going to do. So the power in being, quote unquote, just a mom has been probably one of my greatest gifts through this. And that has led me to be a little bit more progressive because people can open up and be honest about what they're going through, which helps me advocate for those people when I can.
I think that's common with moms. So many of the loss survivor books are written by moms. A few years ago, I was helping my husband care for my mother-in-law when she was in hospice care, and I was so surprised to see that the published signs of impending death are nearly identical, whether they're from cancer or depression.
That does not surprise me at all. At all. I think that is the humanity in it. When human beings' bodies feel like they're dying, whether it's because of a mental illness or a physical illness or a combination of the two, there have to be commonalities. There has to be a point that we can look at that and say, yes, yes, and we're willing to treat it. It's not fine, but it's treatable. It's not something that you have to give up on.
You're listening to STAY, a program about suicide prevention and postvention and our community resilience response. We're here with Juliette Carr from Attempted Suicide Help, which is a foundation and also the title of a book that she wrote and published. How can people access your services?
Certainly. It's on the World Wide Web, attemptedsuicidehelp.com. I also have a Facebook page that's Attempted Suicide Help. And on Twitter, it's Ash, which is A-S-H underscore help. So any of those are ways that you can reach me. You can also go to Amazon and search for Attempted Suicide, the Essential Guidebook for Loved Ones. And my next book, Attempted Suicide, Answers from People Who Have Attempted, will be published soon.
You and I both know that attempt survivors have never been studied in the history of psychology. There's never been a long-term medical study of suicide attempt survivors or their families.
That is correct. Which
what research would you like to see in the area of aftercare?
I would love to see, number one, people take suicidality and suicide attempt survivors seriously. I would like to see a study, and I don't know how you create this other than having quote unquote just moms or just dads interview people where they can be honest, where they can say, locking me up for 72 hours is not useful, where they can say, in my state, attempting suicide is a crime. And so not only did I have to be locked up for 3 days, but then I was a ward of the state until the person who was mentally unstable, who ran the mental health hospital, deemed that I was quote unquote well enough to leave willy-nilly randomly and still gave no tools to my family members. Until we can really get good answers from suicide attempt survivors like that, we're not going to change the system. And when we do get those answers, because I think the work that you and I are doing has provided some of those, we need to change the system. Just because we've been doing it this way doesn't mean that it's working, because clearly it's not. I think that there is a huge number of people that struggle with suicidal thoughts on a daily basis, and they're not alone. Just because we don't talk about it, just because people are afraid to say it out loud. And most of the people that do talk about it make jokes about it. It's that black gallows humor about their own mental health or their own mental stability. Mm-hmm. So I think that being aware that that's a cry for help, or that when someone does crash out after that silly comment, that you're there with compassion and resources that work.
I heard the county has been collecting real-time data from attempt survivors in 3 different local hospitals.
I heard that as well.
Isn't that great?
I think it's fantastic.
We're really grinning at each other. I don't know if people can hear this, but we are grinning like crazy because we've been advocating for this for years.
Yes.
If you could send one thing home with every school child in the parent packet, what would you send?
Oh, gosh, that's a fantastic question as well. It would have to be something about mental health, unequivocally. It would have to be coupled with resources for teachers so that they feel empowered to make change. Because I've stood in hallways too many times and watched teachers brush actions and words under the rug because they don't feel empowered to make a change. I think it would have to be something that would empower students, for them to know that they can make a difference.
You and I, we're on the same page with the recently twice failed youth suicide prevention bill,
which
was a bipartisan bill in Colorado, yet it failed upon partisan lines. And I think we're all in the same boat. We are from multiple parties, and we've had it. Are you willing to vote across party lines to get this passed the next time? Because I certainly am.
Absolutely. I always vote across party lines. I think one of the things that as human beings we need to stop and realize is that all of us want what's best for our country or our state or our communities. And it can't be about what color your shirt is or what party gives you money. It has to be about the passion to make a difference and to do things for the right reason.
What are your personal resiliency practices? How do you stay healthy?
The first thing that I had to do to stay healthy was to decide that I would not ever attempt suicide or die by suicide. That's a decision that has to be made, because until that decision is made, it's a tool in your toolbox and it's a go-to. Well, I could always just blah, blah, blah. I could always end this. I could always make it go away. It's my choice. You have to make that decision. The second thing that I do is I set really strict boundaries. There's times that might be debilitating for me, but it's incredibly important for me to have those really good boundaries so that I feel safe and that I feel respected and heard. And I think the third thing that I do is mantras. Three of the best mantras that I found so far are from a book called Lessons from Water. And I repeat many, many times a day, Juliet, I love you. Juliet, I thank you. Juliet, I respect you. Because if you do that over and over again, that's the book I would send home with kids. There it is. I would send that home, because then they would learn to say their name and say that they respect themselves, they love themselves, and they thank themselves. And if you are acting out of a place of respect and love and gratitude, you're not going to harm yourself or anyone else.
So you're saying you're writing a children's book?
Yes, that is. That's definitely one of the next things. My goal was to write 4 books on this subject. So the 2 I've already spoken about, the 3rd would be Attempted Suicide, the Essential Guidebook for Teens. And the 4th would be Attempted Suicide, the Essential Guidebook for Children.
Thank you so much for all you do for the community, both locally and on a national and international level.
Thanks for having me, Erica.
That's all for this episode of Stay, and we hope you'll tune in next time. Thank you for listening to Stay here on KWSILP. I'm Erica Kitzman. If you or someone you know are in crisis, here are some resources. You can call 800-273-TALK for veterans, choose option 1. LGBT youth can call 866-488-7386. Spanish 888-628-9454. For trans individuals, call 877-565-8860. For the podcast of this show and further information about Stay, or if you've missed any of these numbers, please go to kwsi.org.